All right, I'm Otto, I'm alcoholic. I'm just gonna start with another set aside prayer and we'll have Jared come up here. So God, please help us set aside what we think we know about ourselves, the 12 steps, our illness, and especially you, so we can have a brand new experience of all these things. Please let us see the truth. Amen.
Good morning, everybody. Morning. Everybody doing good?
Yeah.
Who had the coffee last night? Anybody get to sleep? Come 12:30, I was sitting up here just staring, watching reruns of like Forensic Files. It doesn't matter what hotel you go to, you can always find Forensic Files. I don't know if you're into that. Either way, good morning, everybody. My name is Jared Dickey. I am a recovered alcoholic. God separated me from alcohol September the 5th, 2015. For that, I'm truly grateful. So we got a lot to cover in a short amount of time today. And, you know, as if you've been to conferences, conventions, you know what I mean, that kind of thing, sometimes you may see that it's like, you know, hey, we spent a whole bunch of time in the front part of the book, and then, you know, we run out of time just flapping our gums and stuff like that. And then by the end of the day, it's like, oh, well, step 12 is pretty important. You guys do that too. We'll see you next year. Have a great time. We don't want to do that. We want to give all the service that we can to, you know, to step 12 because it's extremely important. And so understandably, you know, we're going to hit all the high notes and stuff like that and share our experience with a lot of the rest of the work. But we want to, you know, we want to get to 12 so that we can rock that out too. So just a little bit of house cleaning to kind of recap some of the stuff that we talked about is step one. We beat that up last night. Step one basically is telling me that I'm screwed. Right? Forgive my language. Step one says you're screwed. If you're the real alcoholic, you're condemned to do it again and again against your will. You're screwed. So if I'm screwed, what else is there? How do I get unscrewed? I had a sponsee ask me that. It's like, yes, that's a solid question. How do I get unscrewed? All right. Step two, very, very simple question. Do you guys believe, better yet, I'll ask you all. Do you guys believe that there's a power working in John's life that's keeping him sober today? Yeah. Do you hope that power can work for you? Yeah. Awesome. Step two is done. It's that simple, right? Notice we didn't say anything about Jesus, Buddha, Allah, Krishna. It doesn't matter. I'm screwed in step one. I hope it's working for this guy, can work for me. Why? Because I'm screwed in step one. Pretty easy, right? Step three, can I make a decision to go through the rest of the work like my life depends on it? Because it does, right? So we're going to get into to step four. So if you have a book, please turn over to page 64. Turn to page 64 in your hymnals. All right. So one of the reasons why I kind of like doing this is because whenever we're speaking at a treatment center or something like that, we kind of play this like Mythbusters. Because there's a whole lot of myths out there, right? There's a whole lot of slogans and one-liners and things that get passed from word of mouth and stuff like that, and stuff that's not found in the book, right? And so fortunately, we can share from our experience and from what the book says on what actually needs to happen, what needs to take place in this process. How do we put these things into practical application? I think I was talking with some folks out there around the smoke pit. You ever play that game telephone whenever you were kids? Yeah. You know what I mean? Or even now? I don't know. So think about it this way. I tell Norris something, right? He's going to go around the table and he's going to say it to some of his guys. And by the time it makes it all the way around the room, guess what? It's completely different. We don't have a word of mouth program. It's not what this is, right? It's black and white, clear as crystal, and it's laid out precisely, right? It's not my interpretation. It's not my spin on the steps, right? And playing that game with myself or with someone else's life can be detrimental, right? Getting into this inventory process, I'm sure that you've noticed, if you've read the book, a lot of you have, I'm sure everybody has, that by the time we make it to page 44, they're not talking about alcohol anymore. Who are they talking about? Talking about me, right? Drunk or sober, how do I present myself? How do I run life? How do I try to run your life, right? How am I playing God? And all of the things that I bring to the table are the things that are blocking me off from fully experiencing God, right? We talked about the restlessness, irritability, discontentedness, right? We talked about the stuff that's all on page 62, okay? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Right? It doesn't say Turkey 101 and Fruit Punch 4 Locos, because I would have thought that's what it was. That's the root of my troubles. No, it's talking about selfishness, self-centeredness. So think about this. Where are the roots on a tree? Underground, right? What if I go off into the garden and I cut a weed off at ground level? What's going to happen? It will grow back. Why? Didn't tackle the root of the problem. Drinking is the above ground stuff. Guaranteed to return unless I tackle the root of the problem. Right? The root of the problem is me, is self, right? And I have to die the death of self before the physical death, right? John talked about it yesterday. It says on the, you know, in the middle part of 62 that, why don't I just go there? It's right here. Our troubles are basically of our own making, and they arise out of ourselves. The alcoholic is an extreme example of self will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. And above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. So the question is how on earth is selfishness going to kill me? How is self going to kill me? Well, booze is just waiting. This mental obsession is just waiting for me to get too restless, too irritable, too discontent, right? Enough for me to say, you know what, this sucks. I know I will fix it, right? And then I'm back into the bottle again, and for me to drink is to die. Right? But there are certain circumstances where this illness may go underground and resurface in other areas, right? I'm sure you probably heard other speakers talk about this. You know, it may show up as in, I know that booze is going to kill me. At least I'm slightly awake to that. So you know what? I'm going to reach for something outside of me to fix what's going on inside of me. And I may do that with food, right? I may do that with emotions. I may do that with money. Go on a spending spree, right? Or go on an eating spree. I'm eating up half of Dallas. You know what I mean? We may do that with sex, right? Maybe spending too much time on the internet, looking at things that you shouldn't be looking at, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm reaching for something outside of me to fix what's going on inside. And those things will work up until the point that they don't. Then my mind says, this sucks. I know what will fix it. And I'm back into the bottle again. Does that make sense? Right. And so everything that I bring to the table up to this point, old ideas, misconceptions and perceptions of who I think I am, what I think God is. And that's why chapter 4 begs us. It begs us. Can I lay aside prejudice? Right? Can I lay aside everything I think I know about myself, about God, about the program, about relationships, about, you know, people, about how I present myself for an open mind and a new experience today, right? And so now we're going to get into the inventory process. I can't work on my selfishness. Me working on my selfishness is more, yes, more selfish. Jared wakes up in the morning, you know what, I think I'm just not going to be so selfish today. Who am I already thinking about? Me, right? I can't work on my selfishness. This is why I have to have God's help. If I could have worked on my selfishness, or better yet, you hear it all the time, I'm just working on my character defects. No, I can't do that, right? If I could have done that, I would have done it a long time ago. I'd never be here. You'd have a different speaker here today, right? I cannot do that. All I can do is go through the work, apply the principles, right? God does the rest of the work, and he does it in his own time. That's for a talk later this afternoon. But So what we're coming to do into this inventory is to uncover, discover, and discard the things that have been blocking me off from fully experiencing God, right? A lot of times in step two, people will come to the table, they may already have a belief in God, right? Belief is not enough. Belief is not enough. I need connection. I need connection to this power. I believed all through my drinking career. I prayed myself straight to the liquor store several times. Anybody else done that? Yes, exactly. I had belief. Problem is I wasn't connected. And that's what we want to do, is we want to clear out all of the wreckage in 4 through 9, right? Be rid of these things, have God remove them so that now I'm an open book. I'm an empty vessel so that I can be filled back up again and go out and share this experience with other people, right? So a lot of times people will think that, better yet, I'll ask a question. Anybody ever work for a company that has taken an inventory? Take an inventory of all the products and stuff like that? Okay, a good handful of people. So check it out. Do you want to spend 2 months taking an inventory? Do you want to spend a year taking inventory? No. It's not probably the most favorable thing to do. What I want to do is I want to show up early on a Saturday. I want to knock out this inventory really quick in just a couple of hours, and then I want to go home and spend the rest of the day with the wife and kids. Right? That's the kind of mindset that we should take into this inventory. It doesn't need to be a long, drawn-out process. If I understand that these are the things that are killing me, why not get them down on paper to be rid of them quickly, right? Because there's a new life on the other end, okay? So in this personal inventory, we're going to focus on three different things. But before I get into those three different things, we'll use another example of this inventory process. So here on 64, talks about it being, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process, right? So just putting check marks on a piece of paper, walking around the store or something like that, and checking to see what I have, that's fact-finding, right? Do I have lemon heads, right? Do I have candy? Do we have smokes in the store? Do we have, bread? Do we have this kind of stuff? Yes, 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 right? Taking a closer look at these things, looking at the expiration date, right? That's fact-facing, right? So think about if I did own a convenience store and I go around every single day and I'm doing this inventory, I'm checking the list, blah, 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 we got all these things and we got some milk, right? I'm sure some of you have probably heard this analogy. I got milk. And every time I go around, I've got a case full of milk, right? Check it off. A couple of weeks rolls around, and I notice a lot of folks aren't coming into my store. And I'm wondering why. So I'm going to take a closer look, the fact-facing. Go around, okay, looks like we're good on candy, good on smokes. I come in a little closer, and I look at milk, and it's like a solid piece. You know what I mean? It's turned into a different dairy product, right? And now I start to see why people aren't coming into the store again, right? It's smelling terrible, right? But I don't want to get rid of that milk. I mean, that milk cost me like $8 a gallon, Maybe someone will buy it, I don't know. But what I don't understand is that not only am I losing money on the milk, but I'm losing money on everything in the store, right? Because no one wants to even come into the store because of the smell. So we can't fool ourselves on cost or value or that one resentment is greater than another, right? Because it's there, it exists, right? And as the book tells us a little bit later, to the precise extent that we permit these, do I squander the hour that might have been worthwhile? I permit that milk to live on my shelf, right? But now the whole store is losing out on things that could have been worthwhile out there, right? So it goes on to say, toward the bottom paragraph, it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. The recipe for recovery, the recipe to become a recovered alcoholic, right? But what we have to understand is the spiritual malady is not part of this illness, right? It is a small factor within this. The spiritual malady is not unique to alcoholics. Everybody can experience the spiritual malady. Charlotte Airport yesterday. Mitchell came to pick us up. You see all sorts of people doing some pickup maneuvers and stuff like that, just blocking everybody up, you know what I mean? People giving other people driving directions with their hands, you know what I mean? It's spiritual malady is alive and free, right? Everywhere. Don't believe me? You can turn on the news. You see all the horrific stuff that's happening these days, you know what I mean? Guess what? The spiritual malady is there. Better yet, you ever been to Walmart during Christmas trying to find a parking spot or the mall, something like that? You'll see the spiritual malady. Or in the return line, you know what I mean? Yeah, the spiritual malady is there. It is not unique to alcoholics. The only issue with that is that for alcoholics and perhaps drug addicts, we're an extreme example of self-will run riot. This is exponentially greater within us than it is a lot of the other folks. But with the other folks, guess what? They don't need a 12-step program to get free, right? They don't need one at all. Unfortunately, we do, because what happens is that I stew on some of these things, right? The spiritual malady begins to grow, right? Because I'm fear-based, I'm insecure, and that hang on to that fear long enough, guess what? It turns into a resentment. For me, resentment's the number one offender. It's gonna kill more alcoholics than anything else, right? So going into this personal inventory, we're gonna cover three things. We're gonna cover resentments, right? Deep-seated ill will, right? Who are you pissed off at? Who do you have a grudge against, right? Resentment is anything, you know, by definition, that kind of helps me rethink, refeel, relive a situation, okay? And so when we get these things down on paper, I'm looking at the people who are still eating my lunch today, right? The people that I constantly think about. But it's not just people, it could be places, institutions, it could be ideas, you know what I mean? What are the things that I'm constantly thinking about? And you know, when we get these things down on paper, I'm gonna start in the present, I'm gonna work my way backwards. And one of the people that I'm probably not going to put on here, let's say, you know, if I haven't thought about them in several years, guess what? I'm probably not gonna put them on this inventory. You know, little Johnny who tricked me in the lunch line in third grade? No, I'm probably not gonna put him on there. But the person that I'm constantly thinking about, day in, day out, that I get reminded about, that's the person who I'm gonna end up putting on this inventory, okay? The second part of this inventory, we're gonna look at fear. What's the fear? Why do I have it? Third part of this inventory, we're gonna look at sex conduct, right? Has nothing to do with the act of sex. Has everything to do with relationships. How have I treated people in relationships that I said that I cared about? Right? Can be anybody. Could be personal relationships, could be sexual relationships, right? Could be the people closest to me, right? Could be people that I don't even know, right? But how have I treated them in relationships? So before we get into those latter ones, we're gonna sit here and we're gonna focus on resentments. So on page 65, it gives us a wonderful rubric on what this inventory is supposed to look like, okay? It gives us three columns, and then in two pages, it talks about the fourth column, okay? So the first column is actually a pretty easy one, right? Everybody knows how to make a grocery list, right? Milk, eggs, bananas, blah, blah, blah. That's how we end up working these columns. I don't work across, right? I work the column. Think of all the people who I'm pissed off at, or I'm upset with, or I have a resentment towards, right? The things that I have resentments towards. So picture it this way. If we look at column one on page 65, I'll give you some of my own, right? My wife, my dad, my mom, my brother, Homeward Bound, this is a treatment center in Dallas. You know what I mean? City of Garland, blah, blah, blah. I'm making a list, right? And the instructions that we usually give one of our proteges is, work the first column, say a prayer, tell God thanks, then move on to the next column. And one important key fact that I completely forgot to tell you guys is that when I go into this, I'm going to invite God. As I should get into the habit of, no matter where I go, I'm going to bring God into this. Because a lot of times going into it, there's a lot of fear, right? There's a lot of ambivalence, perhaps, you know? But as long as I bring God into this, it becomes a spiritual process. It becomes a spiritual exercise. And whatever spills off the pen is what God would have. Right? And sometimes, if you've done this, you're sitting down, you're getting ready to write, you say a prayer, and all of a sudden names just start spilling off the pen. You know what I mean? It's almost like I'm not even thinking. They're just coming. Okay? So we've finished our first column. Right? I may have people, I may have institutions, I may have ideas. Right? Say a prayer, I tell God thanks, and now I go into the second column. The second column is, why am I upset? Why am I resentful? Right? What's the cause? What did this person do? So I'll give you my wife. Okay. Now, unfortunately, my wife isn't here, and sometimes we do, she's in Al-Anon, so we get to come up and sometimes do conferences together. So she'll tell her side of the story, I'll tell my side of the story. Everybody always says, okay, let's see if Jared's telling the truth. But for the sake of the talk, what is the cause? Well, she threatened divorce, threatened to take the kids. She took my truck keys. She took my debit cards and my credit cards, right? All bullet points. Notice that in this example, it's all bullet points. It's not some long Hemingway diatribe, you know what I mean? Well, the barometric pressure was about 20, and it was a late June day, you know what I mean? No. We don't need to get into that, right? It's bullet points, little talking points for whenever we get into a fifth step, all right? What are the reasons? Because the point is that we're trying to be objective when we come to this, not subjective. And that's why we work columns the way that we do. Because if you picture this, and sorry, I keep wanting to look back behind me as if I had like a dry erase board back here, so forgive me. If I'm working across in these columns, then now I'm rethinking, refeeling, and reliving, right? And if I stew in that stuff long enough, I start to get a little thirsty, right? So thirsty that it's like, well, you know what? Why even do this again? You know what I mean? And that doesn't happen every single time, but it's a possibility, right? And so that's why we want to continue to remain objective. So in the cause, I'm marking all of these things down. Okay, another example, city of Garland, right? What did they do? Well, they arrested me. You know what I mean? And that's it. That's it. So now if we look at the third column, we're going to look at these different areas of self that were affected by this resentment. Okay, 64 going into 65 gives us these examples. Okay, it says we asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships were hurt or threatened, okay? So let's take the example with my wife, okay? A lot of times in personal relationships or someone that you're really, really close to, it's almost every single thing across the board. Chances are it is everything across the board, okay? So when I had this when I have this resentment towards my wife, it hurt my pride, right? Because I can't stay sober. She's threatening divorce. I can't even hold down a job. I can't hold down a marriage, right? She's threatening to take the kids. So that affects my ambitions, where I want to go with my family, what our ideals are, that kind of thing. She took my debit cards and my credit cards. So guess what? That affects my pocketbook. That one's pretty easy. And my personal relationships. And my sexual relationships, you know? Because I'll give you a little sidebar story. And this kind of is fifth step related. I don't usually tell anybody this, but what we have to understand is how sick sometimes our minds can end up going. So I'm drinking myself to death, right? Going, weeks upon weeks, sometimes even months without any intimacy in our relationship, right? I end up going into treatment and probably found the one counselor that wants to feed into this, right? We start talking about it. You know, I start to feel like it's not frequent enough. It's not the things that I want and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, well, it sounds to me like you're a sex addict. I'm like, okay, maybe that's it. Yeah, that's it. But then later on, come to a fifth step. It was one of the things that I put on here. You know what I mean? And my sponsor said, Jared, you're drinking yourself to death, right? Day in and day out, you can barely pull together a sober breath. I'm like, well, yeah, man, that's true. He said, Jared, are you showering? Well, I mean, I don't know, maybe like every couple of weeks or so, I don't know. It's gross, right? He said, Jared, how long would you put up with you? Like, well, I kind of wouldn't. He's like, does that seem attractive at all? You come in smelling like a bar, right? You've probably got, you know, puke all over you, that kind of stuff. Would you want to sleep with you? Like, no. He said, so do you really think that that's what you are? That you're a sex addict? No. I just can't pull together a sober breath for anything to happen, right? But my mind fed into this, right? These resentments, whether fancied or real, had the power to kill. And I would use that as a crutch. I'd use it as being a victim. And we'll talk about that here in 2 seconds. So we'll hold off on the fourth column, right? And we'll go into some important things that a lot of people don't usually like to talk about, okay? So in this fourth column, it tells us to disregard what the other person did entirely, right? You can find this on page 67. Says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs that others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Our own mistakes. Does it say my part? No. It says my mistakes. We have to kick the my part to the curb, okay? Because if you think about it this way, if I'm looking for my part, my sick, twisted alcoholic mind will say your part is 99%, mine's just 1%. Right? Let's run with that. I'm looking for my mistakes. Where did I set the ball rolling? Where was I at fault? Okay. Now, a lot of times, many of us have gone through some terrible, tragic things. Things that we kind of talked about yesterday, right? Things like abuse, molestation, rape. Don't wish these things on anybody. Okay. And I'm not making light of any of this stuff, guys. Please hear me out. Because oftentimes this is the fuel to the fire in some of this four-step stuff. And the question always comes up, how on earth was I at fault for this? The truth is, I am not at fault for the act. Right? The act of what happened, whether it happened as a child, a teenager, an adult, just the other day, it doesn't matter. The act of what happened is not my fault, but what I choose to become afterwards is my responsibility. I have to take responsibility for that. And the way that that shows up is if I was abused by a man, okay? And do I hold relationships with men at arm's length from this point forward, right? Do I condemn every single father figure? Do I use this abuse as a victim card and throw it out every single time, right? Well, you drink like I drink if this was you, you know, that kind of thing. We have to be able to see the truth around this. Did this happen at a very young age and I'm holding on to it for 20 years or whatever and not saying anything to anybody? Did I seek help, right? If I'm choosing not to seek help, then I'm choosing to hold on to that. Right? And what I become, robbing people out of having 100% of me, right? That's my fault. That's my responsibility. Is this making sense? Right. So again, I'll say, the act of what happened is not my fault, but what I choose to become after that, that's what I have to take responsibility for. Okay. And I'm happy afterwards to talk to anybody personally about that. But when we get into a fifth step a little bit later on, it talks about getting everything out on the table, right? I've sat in front of scores of men who will put a lot of stuff out on the table, but they'll hold on to this, right? They'll hold on to this. They'll go out, they do some more drinking, and they come back, and it's like, well, you know what? I wasn't 100% honest. And this is what they end up dispelling. But what we have to understand is that there's hope on the other side. In those kind of situations, no matter how bad, no matter how tragic they are, can be uniquely useful to somebody else who's also walked through that, right? That being a notch on your belt, you can be uniquely useful to the person who's still struggling with that. So moving on. Taking back to the, let's use the city of Garland, right? Now we're gonna work this fourth step, okay? City of Garland, what was the cause? Well, they arrested me, right? Got sent to jail as Spider-Man. That is part of a true story. It's during a costume party, and I get arrested. I went to jail as Spider-Man. Yeah. One piece leotard. It's not not one of my best moments, right? So, if I put this down as one of my resentments, and I'm starting to look at this fourth column. Now we got to get to the truth. My sponsor's asking me all sorts of questions. He's like, Jared, were you driving while intoxicated? Yes. And he's like, there you go. That's your fault. You decided to break the law. You made a conscious decision to break the law, and now you're upset for them just doing their job? Well, yeah. So an example of that is pretty easy to see the truth around, right? Now let's go to the example of my wife. Okay, let me make sure I'm doing good on time. So for my wife, if I'm looking at where my mistakes were, like we kind of talked about a little bit, I'm drinking myself to death. Okay, and as in the normal alcoholic life, I'm lying, I'm stealing, I'm manipulating. You know what I mean? And I'm being incredibly dishonest, right? So. Like any good Al-Anon or someone, just a loved one of anybody who's dealing with people like us, they're going to react in a lot of different ways. Right? They react in a lot of different ways. Sometimes people will smother us. Oh, you know, I'm just going to stay around them and I'm going to make sure that they don't drink, blah, blah, blah. Other people, they'll, you know, just cut us off completely. Some people will do a mixture of all of these things. Right? So for my wife, the way that she tried to keep me from drinking was, you know, whenever I'm passed out, she comes and gets in my wallet, takes out the debit cards and stuff like that, and puts them in a safe spot. Because at this time, I'm spending up money that we're not making. You know what I mean? And this is why I ended up resorting to stealing, because I didn't have any money. You know? And so my sponsor asked me, Jared, don't you think she's trying to do the best that she can with what she was given? Do you know how this, you know, this illness not only just affects the alcoholic, but it affects the family as well. The book talks about it in several places. It can make any you know, child neurotic, any wife, you know, crazy, because they have to deal with people like us. You know what I mean? So much so that there's a whole other fellowship created for them. You know what I mean? And so in some of the examples that I was given, you know what I mean? She took my truck keys. Why? Because she was afraid for my life. She didn't want me out there on the road driving around. Can I blame her? You know? And so what's happening is, and this is how we kind of have to combine the fourth and fifth step just for the sake of the talk, is that I begin to see a pattern develop. I begin to see how I present myself to other people, right? And it's not just one person. It's almost everybody who I show up to in their life, right? I'm like a chameleon. This still ties into the third step, right? I assign people roles, and I expect you to live up to that role. The unfortunate part is that I never give you a script, and you're going to screw it up. That's what happens. But the way my sick alcoholic mind goes is, you suck, you must die. You can't play the role that I, you know what I mean? And we laugh about that, but in all seriousness, that's exactly how far I take it. You know what I mean? I'll just write you off, or I'll be pissy toward you. You know what I mean? I can play all of these different roles. Think about it this way, like in part of my story, like in high school, if you looked in my closet, I'd have various sets of wardrobe, right? If I'm hanging out with these people this week, guess what? I'm wearing these kind of clothes over here so that I can fit in. If I'm hanging out with these guys over here, I'm gonna wear this set of wardrobe, you know what I mean? And because I'm fear-based, I'm insecure, And I think that this is what you need to see in order for you to like me. And I think that this is what you need to see in order for me to get what I want. I don't get what I want, guess what? You know what I mean? That's where I take it. And so when working this four step and sitting across from another man in a fifth step, we try to bring about some of these, or we try to bring these patterns to the forefront, right? So that doing this fifth step doesn't take forever, right? Oftentimes, I've heard people tell all sorts of horror stories from fifth steps. It's like, oh yeah, we spent all day. We just called a break and we're going to pick it up the next day. You know what I mean? That's ridiculous. Totally ridiculous, right? I have never done a fifth step within the past 6 years that has lasted more than 2 hours, right? Because as a sponsor, sitting in front of somebody else who's reading this stuff, the more I let you talk, the more you justify your bad behavior, okay? We have to get down to causes and conditions, right? Read just what's on paper. I always preface before we go into this. It's like, dude, let's say a prayer. Let's bring God into this, and here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you to stick what's on paper. Stick with that. If I need a backstory, if I need some answers, I'll ask you a couple of questions. Otherwise, let's stick with what's on paper. Okay? And that way we're able to go boom, 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 cut and dry. You know what I mean? Get to the fourth column really quick. Find out the truth about that. Now, guess what? The pattern's up in the forefront. Now we get to the next person. Boom, 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 boom. Guess what? Same pattern. Doesn't matter if you have 200 resentments or 20 resentments, you begin to see this pattern so much so, right? And we beat that fourth column up so much that the first three really become a lie. I did all of this because I made a decision based on self, right? Drinking myself to death, driving while intoxicated. Guess what? I'm the one who put myself in a position to be hurt, right? They're just being them. They're being themselves, reacting on what I'm doing, right? The book describes this as a tornado roaring through their lives. So guess what? They're trying to find shelter. They're trying to self-preserve. They're trying to protect, right? But I'm thinking that these people are doing this to me, right? I'm just walking around whistling and all of a sudden someone just comes and hits me in the head. You know what I mean? No, it's because I placed myself in a position to be hurt, right? And so when this pattern becomes prevalent, going through the other 180 resentments is almost pointless because it's the same pattern. Does that make sense? That's how this becomes easier. That's how it doesn't need to go for, you know, days on end in doing one of these things, because it's the same with each and every single person. I'm fear-based because of all of these areas of self that are affected, you know. I assign people roles. I place myself in a position to be hurt, so on and so forth. Does that make sense? Hopefully. I'm happy to talk to anybody else afterward. So let's move on to fear real quick. Simple question is, what is the fear? Why do I have it? Pretty easy. What's the fear? Why do I have it? Now, if you would have asked me, like, you know, 10, 12 years ago, Jared, what are you afraid of? Man, I ain't afraid of nothing. I'm tough, right? But then you get me down, sitting, you know, put a piece of paper in front of me, it would have been easier for me to tell you the things that I wasn't afraid of, because I was afraid of everything. And the interesting part about it is when we really look at the truth, I'm afraid of the opposite of a lot of things. I'm afraid of everything. Matter of fact, I'm just a ball of fear, you know what I mean? Running through life. As the book says, it's an evil and corroding thread. The very fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It affects every single aspect of my life, right? So think about it this way. I'm writing out a fear column in step one, right? What am I afraid of? Well, I'm afraid of drinking again, right? Afraid of not being successful. Afraid of losing my family. I'm afraid of not holding down a job, right? So those are a few examples. Now let's look at the opposite of that. Before we look at the opposite, I'm afraid of drinking again, right? Oh my gosh, do I need to walk around life? Do I need to keep my trigger list on me? Do I need to stay on guard? Do I need to keep my Gorski relapse prevention manual in my pocket? You know what I mean? Oh my gosh, now I'm working myself into a tizzy, right? And now I'm back to drinking again, just all because of fear. But now let's look at the opposite of that. I'm afraid of not drinking again. Oh my gosh, what does a sober life look like? What am I gonna do without alcohol? Am I gonna be able to go to weddings? Am I gonna be able to go to parties, bar mitzvahs? You know what I mean? Now I'm working myself back into it again, right? The same with not being successful. What's it gonna look like? I can't hold down a job. I'm gonna be homeless, broke, unemployed, unemployable. Oh my God, I'm gonna die. And now being successful, oh my gosh, now I'm gonna be sober again, and am I gonna be part of a Fortune 500 company? I don't really know. What am I gonna do? See what I mean? I'm just working myself up because of fear. And whom, as the book tells us, who am I relying on 99.9% of my life? How well is my way working? It's not at all, right? But God's way is simple and easy. Right? And that's why a lot of times people say, well, we have to learn to live life on life's terms. No. Living life on life's terms gets me thirsty. How about living life on God's terms? Now, that's a little bit different. Right? Now, you may come to the point in the book where it says that we may sometimes class fear with stealing. It's kind of weird. Fear and stealing? I'll explain this. If I am gripped with fear, fear is selfish, okay? There are two different types of fear. There's healthy fear, and then there's selfish fear. Healthy fear, the building's on fire, get out. There's a bear running at me, run. Healthy fears, right? Selfish fears, right? Completely different. If I am consumed with fear, then who am I thinking about? Thinking about me. If I'm thinking about me, how can I be helpful to you? I can't, because I'm thinking about me. And effectively, I become a thief. And I rob each and every single person out there, including myself, including God, of having an effective part of me, 100% of me. This is stuff that we end up coming up with in the fourth column as well, right? Because I'm blocked off from God, because I'm selfish, self-centered, I'm thinking only of myself. Did I ever give these people 100%? Did I ever give my kids 100% out of me? Did they get the dad that they deserved? Did my wife get the husband that she deserved? 100%. Did my employers get 100% of an employee that they needed? No, because I'm consumed with fear. I've robbed them out of time. I've robbed them out of money. I've robbed them out of a personal relationship. I've robbed them out of peace of mind. And I've robbed God out of having an effective agent. See how that works? That's how we class fear with stealing. We're all thieves. If you're a real alcoholic, you may have physically robbed somebody, but guess what? I can also rob somebody emotionally, spiritually as well. Right? And so now we move on to sex conduct. Right? So again, has nothing to do with the act of sex, has everything to do with relationships, okay? Personal relationships, so I'll spill the beans. I unfortunately had a lot of one-night stands, okay? It's not something that I'm proud of, but it's something that I can look back on and see the truth, right? How have I treated people in relationships? Am I just treating them like Kleenex? Use them for what I want and toss them to the curb? Am I using relationships as like arm candy? Look who I'm dating. Look who I'm taking to the ball. Look who I'm taking to the dance or to the bar, or to the club, that kind of thing. You know? Just using it as a deal to boost my ego. And the book asks us several questions. Where did we unjustifiably arouse bitterness, suspicion, anger, jealousy, or the like? We put each relationship to the test. Was it selfish or not? Did I get into this relationship, right, however short-lived, just for me, just to get what I want out of it, right? And some of you may be shocked to hear this. I can put God in this as well. How have I treated God in this relationship? I said that I love God, but am I treating him like Santa Claus? asking him just for what I want. I need this, I need this, I need this. But I'm never fulfilling my end of the bargain, right? Each relationship, we give 100%. They give 100%, I give 100%, right? But if I'm only getting whatever I want out of it, then that's me being selfish. Am I using my powers, am I using my sex powers for good or for bad? The best example that I can use is for women. Did you ever maybe flaunt a little something to get someone to buy you a drink? Perfect example. Perfect example right there. I'm not using my sex powers for how they were created, right? I'm using them for my own benefit, right? I'm going to pretend that you're going to be able to go somewhere, find someone, something, do something with me by just, you know, giving you a little taste. Now I get what I want. See ya. Does that make sense? Yeah. So one piece that's often overlooked, if we look down here on the bottom of 69, it says, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? Now, I'll tell you a little something that my sponsor set with me on whenever I kind of went through this laundry list of one-night stands and how I had treated women, how I treated people that I said that I cared about. And he said, at the time that I got sober, my daughter was like 2.5. And he said, Jared, you love your daughter, right? I said, yes, absolutely. And he said, you love your wife, you love your mom, you love your aunts, you love your grandmother. You know what I mean? All of these things. How would you feel if someone did any of these things to your daughter, or treated your daughter this way, or treated your mom this way, or your aunt, or your grandmother? It's like, dude, I'd be pissed. He said, then what makes you so special? Who do you think you are that you can go around life treating women like this, or treating people like this? You know what I mean? Like garbage. That hit home real quick. Real quick, because I love my daughter. And so now what the book tries to get us to do is to formulate a new safe and sound sex ideal. Okay? And the reason why I say it's often overlooked is because it gives us instructions here. Right? Whether we want to put it on paper or not, it's still part of this inventory. Right? And we move with it into the fifth step and into 6 and 7, right? Whenever we go and spend our hour of quiet time. And so it says, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to the test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. We remembered that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Now, here's the key sentence. Whatever our ideals turn out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. Okay? So in this safe and sound ideal, what I'm doing is I'm now putting out into the world my ideals of what my new relationships are going to be, right? My ideals of what a future partner might be, right? My ideals of what a real man should be, of what a real woman should be, right? And if I'm looking at a partner and I think of all of these attributes and stuff like that I want this partner to be, guess what? I have to be willing to grow towards those as well. I can't expect somebody else to be, you know, kind, selfless, you know, always giving, blah, 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 if I'm not willing to work towards those things as well. Does that make sense? And in this way, we shape a safe and sound ideal about how I need to formulate these relationships moving forward. Always seeing what I can contribute to the relationship and not what I can take away. Right? And we do that with life. And in any situation, what can I bring to the table? Right? We see that in our meetings. Oh boy, I took away a whole lot from that meeting. Okay, what did you contribute to the meeting? Right? Oh, I really needed that meeting. What did you contribute? That's the whole reason for me to go to a meeting. It's not to pull something out of it. It's to contribute to it, right? And to contribute to life. So as we move through this, I'll give you an example, my personal example before I wrap it up here. Is September 5th, 2015 is the day that I got sober. And, you know, I had mentioned yesterday that that was a day of huge desperation. Since then, it hasn't been matched. And on that day, I called up my sponsor and I said, JK, you know, I'm ready to do this. And he's, well, okay, I'll be more honest. I was more like snotting and sniveling. I'm like, JK, I'm ready to do this. Probably not even making any sense, right? And he said, all right, big boy, you've said that before. Let's see what your feet are going to do. Okay? He said, meet me at the group. And so September the 5th, 2015 was a Sunday. On Tuesday, I met him at the group. Right? We recapped some step one stuff. He asked me the step two question that I asked you guys. We got down on our knees. We did a third step prayer, and we stood up. And he said, all right, big boy, you just did the third step prayer. Here's your instructions for four. You have a week to do it, or else. Or else meant go away. Don't waste my time. Right? I still use that to this day. How quickly do I want to be free? Right? And September, on day nine of sobriety, I ended up meeting up over at his house. I did my fifth step, right? Went home, did six and seven. And, you know, I had spent my hour of quiet time and stuff like that. By lunchtime, I made an eight-step list, right? Later on that afternoon, I went out to go make amends, right? Made one or two, okay? Nothing really big, but I made a start, right? Which then rockets me, as the book says, into 10, 11, and 12. Okay? On the way home from one of these amends, somebody gave me a call and said, hey, dude, we're going to Homeward Bound later on tonight to go carry the message. Do you want to come with us? Absolutely. Wouldn't miss it for the world. I'll stop that part of the story right there so that I can save the rest for later, right? This is day nine of sobriety, okay? And we're talking four through nine, moreover, four through 12 in one day, okay? How quickly do I want to be free? As a sponsor, am I letting people flounder out there months and months sitting on this fourth step? Right? When these are the things that are blocking us off from fully experiencing God, knowing full well, I'm a real alcoholic. All I got is a week to a month. If this person's a real alcoholic and I've sat down and I've qualified them and I know that they got a week to a month, why on earth am I allowing somebody to have longer than that to sit on a fourth step, right? Because they're gonna drink again. That's what we do. It does not surprise me whenever someone goes back out and drinks. It does surprise me when someone gets this and stays with this, right? That's when I get surprised. But that's for the sponsorship talk a little bit later on. So with that, I want to thank you guys. John's going to probably pick it up from where I left off. Let's take a little quick 10-minute break. We'll be right back into it.